This week on Thursday Night Talk, host Lorna Bryant is coming to host Thursday Night Talk. As always, we welcome your contributions. Give us a call at 826-4805.
Good evening, and thanks for tuning in to Thursday Night Talk. As Michael stated, I am Lorna Bryant. On July 5th, 2016, Alton Sterling was shot several times at close range while held down on the ground by two white Baton Rouge police officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. On July 6th, 2016, Philando Castile was fatally shot by Hermino Yanez, a St. Anthony, Minnesota police officer, after being pulled over in Falcon Heights, a suburb of St. Paul. On July 7th, 2016, Micah Xavier Johnson ambushed and fired upon a group of police officers in Dallas, Texas, killing five officers and injuring nine others. Two civilians were also wounded. On July 8th, 2016, Baton Rouge police officer Corporal Montrell Jackson wrote the following words on Facebook: "I'm tired physically and emotionally. Disappointed in some family, friends, and officers for some reckless comments, but hey, it's what's in your heart. It's in your heart. I still love you all because hate takes too much energy, but I definitely won't be looking at you the same. Thank you to everyone that has reached out to me or my wife. It was needed and much appreciated. I swear to God I love this city, but I wonder if this city loves me. In uniform, I get nasty, hateful looks. And out of uniform, some consider me a threat. I've experienced so much in my short life, and at these last 3 days have tested me to the core. When people you know begin to question your integrity, you realize they don't speak loud and clear. Finally, I personally want to send prayers out to everyone directly affected by this tragedy. These are trying times. Please don't let hate infect your heart. This city must and will get better. I'm working in these streets so any protesters, officers, friends, family, or whoever, if you see me and need a hug or want to say a prayer, I got you." On July 17th, 2016, Gavin Eugene Long shot six police officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Three died, three were hospitalized, one critically. Of the officers who died, two were members of the Baton Rouge Police Department, while the third worked for East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office. Montrell Jackson was one of those three officers who died on that day. He was 32. Alton Sterling, black man. Philando Castile, black man. Micah Xavier Johnson, black man. Gavin Eugene Long, black man. Montrell Jackson, black man. My guests tonight are Arcata resident Mikey Matthews, HSU professor Kirby Moss, and Sergeant John Packer of the University Police Department here at HSU. Three black men who reside in Humboldt County. We'll talk about how their worlds intersect and sometimes collide. We'll talk about how they navigate through life in America as a black male. I'd like to welcome you all. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line with me is, he's not in the studio, but on the line is Sergeant John Packer. Sergeant Packer, I'd like to start with you after reading that introduction. Are those sentiments that were just read the same? Do you feel the same thing that Montrell Jackson felt as a black man in black skin and in a police officer's uniform?
Well, I think I share some of them, but not all of them.
Okay.
And I think part of that has to do with the smaller community that we're in and the dynamics we have here for me in Arcata, McKinleyville, et cetera. I do share a concern for the relationship between law enforcement and the people we're charged to protect. And I definitely share the sentiments of, if you see me, let's engage in a conversation that doesn't have to revolve around criminal activity or a law enforcement. It can definitely be revolving around just a dialogue and a camaraderie because we all live in the same community.
Absolutely. Now, just to give a little historical background, how long have you lived in this community?
So I've lived in Humboldt County, specifically Arcata or McKinleyville, for 37 years. And I did not move here as a police officer. I moved here as a college student out of Oakland, California, to go to school. And it wasn't until I was, and this is somewhat ironic, I became a police officer when I was 32 years of age. Mm. So I was older when I swore to uphold and serve the Constitution as a police officer.
And let's just talk about your experience as an officer in Humboldt County. I know we're not in a metropolitan city, so you don't feel, do you feel some of that angst that Montrell Jackson spoke of? Do you ever?
I don't know if I feel any racial angst because there's only a few black officers in Humboldt County. I do know that if we want to use a term, and our cultural anthropologists will be better at this. And as I assimilated in this community, there was definitely times at which I've gotten interesting questions or opinions about being black, and had to work through those. But most of them, for the most part, were naive. They weren't adversarial. And then within law enforcement and just the tensions with law enforcement, most of the time when I have a suspect or someone I'm engaged with dropping the N-word and I've been called that as well as a Nazi, most of the time it's an attempt to push my buttons and to be antagonistic towards me, and they'll select out at times race as a as an attempt to push that button, whether that's their own perception of racism, or if that's just an attempt to get me to behave differently.
So we live in what some call a post-racial society. Many beg to differ. We also live in a society now driven by social media. Do you think the perception or how you've been received as a police officer has changed with social media being so prevalent now?
Definitely.
And how so?
Well, here's what happens. When you have instant information, it may be complete, it may be partial, but our community and those around us, but I mean our social networking community, everyone who is on Snapchat or Instagram or Facebook, or what have you, begins to develop a narrative of what did or didn't happen with that police officer shooting, with that racial incident, with that use of force incident. And a number of times, and rightly so, it's based on their interaction with law enforcement. For example, if you were to come down to my hometown in Oakland, a lot of the neighborhoods that I grew up in have the law enforcement involvement specifically revolves around criminal interdiction. So their involvement with law enforcement is typically negative. Hmm. And as opposed to, say, McKinleyville or Humboldt County or Arcata, where the majority of our interaction is on a positive note. Not to say that we don't have criminal events going on in Arcata, but the number and frequency is definitely lower. And so that definitely shapes opinion, that it shapes the response that people have to law enforcement there, because they're concerned. they see something visual, they hear about it, it's conveyed to them, and they, even in Humboldt County, when since some of the shootings that you mentioned, when I've done stops on individual criminal stops for a violation of a traffic violation, I've had individuals, irrespective of the color of my skin, see the uniform and say, hey, you know, my hands are right where you can see them. All I have is my phone in my hand. And so, yeah, it definitely shapes the response to law enforcement when you look at the effects of social media. Now, having said that, I'm not saying social media isn't an evil. It's definitely something that we've progressed, and it's definitely giving us a better view of what's going on in our different communities in that snapshot of a sense.
Well, you mentioned the cultural anthropologist Kirby Moss. So I'm going to turn to you for just a second, and just taking the words that Sergeant Packer just used, what are your opinions on that?
The idea of the role of media?
Yes, yeah, and social media. Yeah.
And I was telling you earlier before we came into the studio that we talk about social media now as though this is a new phenomenon, but if you go back to 1955, the first picture coming out of Jet magazine about Emmett Till, I mean, that was a viral photo in its day, you know, at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. And then you had a lot of content coming from the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement and showing this content on television. So, you know, that created a whole conversation around race and different cultural dynamics in America. So, you know, then you go to Rodney King, and then you come to, you know, the contemporary thing we're looking at. So it's, I think it's, but the difference now is that I think the immediacy is what he's talked about. He said it's so immediate now, and that we become broadcasters of the things we see. And that's the difference compared to the past when, you know, you'd have to vet that through legacy media. But now we can see it and we can just broadcast it. So it's our kind of conscious and subconscious mind is going right into the space, and that makes a difference for sure.
Why don't you expound a little bit on that pivotal moment of the photo of Emmett Till? Maybe others listening may not know that specific in that context. So can you expound on that just a little bit?
Oh, yeah, I think, in the summer of 1955, Emmett Till went down to Mississippi from Chicago to visit family, and within 2 weeks being there, he was, there's a lot to the story, but he was taken out of his aunt's house or his uncle's house and beaten and mutilated and thrown in the river, and they found his body, and they were going to ship the body back to Chicago. And his mother, Mamie Till, as a political statement, she said, I want them to see what they did to my baby. So she wanted the coffin open at the funeral. And so it was a very controversial decision at the time. And the only publication that ran that photo was Jet magazine. And I was listening to a story about that just a bit ago. And the publisher there said, you know, as we do now, it seems like with some of this content that we run, Jet wanted to make a statement, and it horrified people to see that, because when we see these things versus hearing about them or see them written about, the visual nature of it, it's kind of a visceral experience for people. People kind of, they feel it too. They seem like they've experienced it too. So I think Emmett Till was one of the first kind of, I call it viral visual pieces of civil rights content or content on, you know, the black experience out there. You know, we go before that about, you know, the hangings and stuff, but Emmett Till was a very powerful photo.
And, you know, so many times in life, we've all, even at this table and on the phone, expressed the injustice that has occurred in our lives. But, oh, maybe you're blowing it out of proportion. But when you see it before your eyes, like Emmett Till, Now you know the reality.
And a child, too. He was a 14-year-old kid, and that had a different weight to it.
Yeah. A 14-year-old kid who would have incidentally been 75 years old this month.
Mm-hmm.
75. He would have been a grandfather.
Yeah.
He would have been a grandfather, but because he was a black man at 14 years old, he was perceived to be a threat. I'm going to look to you, Mikey. You are that young black man who I'm sure you have quite a social media presence. I'm guessing you have a Facebook and a mm-hmm. Snapchat.
Yeah.
So you know about this immediacy that we're talking about,
yeah.
this real time that you see. Do you see it? You're in Humboldt County, but you're from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Do you see things that are going on in your community in Los Angeles on social media and what's going on, boots on the ground in the inner city?
Well, it's kind of hard, especially being in Humboldt and not being in L.A. and just kind of, I don't know, basing my information on social media is a bit hard. Because I don't get too much information from LA, and whatever I see is just what anybody would put up.
Okay.
And I've kind of based my news and timeline and off of that. And I'm a pretty private person. Like, I'm really introverted, so I don't too much like to, you know, be involved
okay.
On the internet too much. But yeah, for what I've seen, I mean, it's really similar for. You know, what I've gone through in L.A., not so drastic, you know. I haven't dealt with police brutality but I have, you know, endured, you know, microaggressions for the most part.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you would like to join in on the conversation, you can call 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. Now, there's been talk about why you think the black man is feared. There are three black men in this conversation, with me being the moderator. But what I'd like to know from listeners who are not black men, why is there a fear? So if you'd like to share your feelings as to why you may fear a black man or why you think the black man is feared here, call 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. Now, John, I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
So I know you're a university police officer, but you're also a training officer for CR's Police Academy, correct?
That's correct.
And there's another role you play. I can't remember the exact title, but it's a pretty interesting role. Can you tell me as it relates to race relations?
Okay. So the Peace Officer Standards and Training is run by the Department of Justice, and they have academies throughout the state of California. And I'm an instructor specifically at College of the Redwoods, the Police Academy. And I teach a number of different blocks. I teach how to handle disputes, how to de-escalate them. I teach of a block of instruction that's called bias-based policing, understanding racial profiling within law enforcement, within our community. I also teach tactical communication, and I'm a subject matter expert on those in the sense that I've been teaching for a number of years, close to 20. And my degree is in communications. And then we take, from a training standpoint, we looked at what was going on in the relationship between law enforcement and our communities. And then we reached out to the Museum of Tolerance to help us create a curriculum for police officers to address bias within law enforcement and within our community. So I instruct on that at the Police Academy for every cadet that comes through College of the Redwoods, and also on the Advanced Officer Training Program for Humboldt County, specifically at the College of Redwoods. But I've also gone down and had all of the sheriff's deputies from Marin County SO go through that, Lake County, Mendocino County, over the years that I've been an instructor. And that program's evolved from racial profiling specifically to include all of bias-based policing within within law enforcement within the last couple of years.
So how does that training, or that black as you call it, how does that look? What do you cover exactly?
So we cover a lot of things. For example, we look back at the civil rights movement and what that meant to the black African-American community, the injustices that were done there as it moved through that time period on into specifically California injustices with the Native American community, with our Latino and Latina community, and our Japanese community during World War II. And we look at how that shapes cultural understandings of law enforcement. And then specific to the area, if I'm, for example, teaching it in SCR, I might bring in a speaker from our Native American community to talk about some of the atrocities that went on in Humboldt County. If I'm down in Marin County, I'll have a different guest person that'll come in and talk about the things that have gone on in that specific area that really shape those stories that husband and wife pass on to their kids, that kids pass on to theirs, and so on. And then we also look at how do we reshape that, given our responsibility to uphold the Constitution for all people. And then we also put them through some scenarios to really see what they're coming from, what area they're coming from. We look at what they, if they understand that they have a worldview that shapes how they interact with people as well. So it's pretty intensive. The officers are required to go back through it in advanced officer training every 2 years. And we've been really successful in getting the cooperation of all the departments to come online, mostly because they want to, but also because we audit to make sure that they're in compliance.
Wow. I'm glad to know there's a program like that that exists, and more specifically that you're the one or one of the ones leading that.
Thank you.
So, yes, thank you. Thank you. We do have a caller on the line, Habib from Arcata.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
The conversation steered a little off course from when I called in, but I just wanted to talk to all the members of the panel about the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and how he seems to be shut out of the conversation in the mainstream media, for sure. I mean, he's only considered a radical, but there is strong leadership coming out for black people in America, and I feel he's being overlooked. And I just wondered if you would comment on that, please.
I'll open the floor to any of the men here first.
Well, for me, I'm not that well-versed with Louis Farrakhan and his teachings. I know that he has set his mark in the black community as well as the Islamic community. Just growing up and hearing his name and hearing the conversations and watching people, you know, especially black people, how they respond to his name or, you know, the subject of him, it's usually not that good. though he did speak a lot of wisdom, he spoke a lot of powerful words, he gave a lot of good messages. However, I guess his actions contradicted that.
Well, he's never been known for violence or having any riots or any disturbances after his speeches, and he did organize the Million Man March, and he is, I think he's been painted negative in the mainstream media as anti-white and anti-Catholic Christian or anti-American or anti-this and anti-that, but he actually seems to be, if you actually listen to what he's saying nowadays, I think it has meaning for today, and I just wish Humboldt State, through the Black Student Union or some other method, could get him to come up here to speak. He spoke at UC Berkeley a while back, and it's on YouTube. You can watch it. And he was he had very good oratory skills and was very positive. So I just wanted to throw that out there because he seems to be overlooked, especially up here in our little bubble of the Redwood Curtain.
Well, I was just wanted to jump in and say that as a media person, you hear voices like Farrakhan's and even at the beginning of the presidential primaries. I mean, Sanders and these kind of marginalized voices. The mainstream media is, you know, for decades has marginalized voices like Farrakhan's, and I think people have to go to the alternative media to get those messages, to find out more about those particular folks. But yeah, the mainstream media, I think it's always been, the voices, the messages are too divisive, possibly, and they ignore that because it'll turn so many readers, viewers away. But I know what you're saying about that. I mean, in the alternative media, that more people need to read that.
Yeah. You can't well, I appreciate your time on this issue. And yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. I'd like to also add, you know, coming from Los Angeles, you know, it was nothing like seeing a well-dressed, well-mannered brother in a suit and a bow tie with a bean pie in one hand and a final call in the other.
Yeah.
And that was supporting the Nation of Islam and Minister Louis Farrakhan. People such as Minister Louis Farrakhan and Dr. Umar Jackson are usually demonized because of their what is considered to be rhetoric, but the main focus of these men is black pride and black empowerment, and it's sometimes deemed as negative in the media, sadly. We have another... go ahead.
Well, I think that gets us back to our question of the view of black men in America being really driven by media rather than reality in terms of whatever fears there are out there and how it's really important to look at or to judge what media you're taking in and what their ultimate goal and what their mission is, because it's not always just getting out information. Sometimes it is designed to elicit response, to elicit viewer numbers, and that's the detriment of us as a community when you lose that professional objectivity as a journalist. I'm not a journalist. I do know that law enforcement is definitely at times a target of journalism.
We do have another, thank you for that comment. We do have another caller, Jamie from Arcata. Jamie?
Hi. Hey, listen, I'd like to give maybe one answer to the question, why are black men feared? Mm-hmm. Part of it is that there's a lot of justified anger in the black community, but that anger is not always manifested in a justifiable way. So a young black men who have justifiable anger sometimes behave in ways that justifiably scare white people. So there's a cycle going on there. And I know where the cycle started. I know whose fault it is, basically. But there is a cycle there. So I think maybe recognizing that is a good idea.
How do we break that?
Education, discussions like you're having, teaching all young people how to handle anger, no matter what the source of it might be, in a constructive way. That's not really necessarily a racial question. It's a question of maturity and learning how to be calm and deal with people that that have insulted you or hurt you in a constructive way that'll help you and not make things worse.
And I guess it starts at the home, but if the home is toxic and they're teaching that hate, then where do you go?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, my granddaughter's father is black, and, you know, in the little preschool here, she was the only black kid, and she complained because some of the girls were calling her a skunk. And the headmistress could not believe that that had anything to do with race, but my kid was the only one being called a skunk by these little white girls.
So I
don't know. Maybe I was wrong.
No, I thought it's an interesting question. I mean, for you now, because you were asking, or we were asking earlier, how would black folks deal with that that kind of burden of being black. But now that you said your family member is a black kid, my question to you is, how do you deal with her blackness? And when people say that about her, how does that make you feel?
Well, my impulse is to defend her.
Okay, yeah.
Whether I'm right or wrong, and no matter what the topic is, because she's my kid.
Yeah.
But also there's a constant sort of inquiry going on. Every time something bad happens to her, somewhere in my mind I go, is it because she's black? Or is it just because that person is a jerk?
So
I don't know how to put my finger on that unless somebody's actually overtly racial with their verbal assault or their insult or whatever it is.
It could be both, in all truth. Yeah.
So
well, it could be both, and I think that's that touches on, from a law enforcement standpoint, how people respond when I stop them and when a law enforcement officer pulls them over. A red light comes on, you get pulled over, and in that person's mind, they're asking, what are the reasons that I was pulled over? Is this a legitimate stop? Is it a traffic stop because it's a traffic stop, or is it a traffic stop because, and then they're going to fill in the blank, and that's based on the young girl that he's speaking of now. As she grows up, in her mind, she will ask that question. Is this injustice? Is this difference because of the color of my skin?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then the problem is that if she starts assuming that it is every time somebody is mean to her, she's going to be wrong, at least part of the time.
Well, Jamie, I have a question for you. Did you have that sensitivity as it relates to race prior to the birth of your granddaughter?
I had it in a more abstract way. I was really lucky to be born into a household, a family that had a lot of friends of all different colors and sexual orientations, and that's, you know, artists and all kinds of people. And, you know, my mom had black male friends after she got divorced from my dad. So, you know, I'm lucky that I had the right kind of upbringing in that regard. But, yeah, it was more abstract. Mm. Absolutely. And probably without the experience of the family, it would not have become so deeply ingrained in me to kind of go, okay, let's examine this situation.
Right.
And not be knee-jerk, you know, a fearful white guy, or knee-jerk, hey, how come you're being mean to my black granddaughter? You know, that's knee-jerk, too.
Right. Thank you so much for your call and your comment, Jamie.
Yeah, well, thank you, guys.
So I'll ask John and Mikey and Kirby, when you navigate through life daily and something occurs, is your first reaction, this is going on because I'm a black man, or is this just a random occurrence?
I guess I'll jump in here first. This is Kirby. We were having this conversation earlier, and I say so often, even in my classes, that I'm walking through life every day up in Humboldt or just here in America, and I forget that, you know, I'm black, because not that it's a cultural question or, you know, a question of identity. It's just like I'm trying to get to the store. I'm trying to get to school or grade papers. And so often, if I do engage in a kind of a racial conversation or a racial situation, it's white folks engaging me in that conversation. So my question becomes, I kind of switch the onus to, for me, about what's it like moving through life as a black man, and I switched the onus to, like, what's it like for me moving through life as a black man and white folks encountering that? Because it seems like the onus is on them, because I forgot. I'm just a guy trying to get to the post office this day. And there are the other days things do happen that become racialized, but in general, and I think that's the question we don't really talk about enough, is where does that onus lie?
And for me, I mean, being in Humboldt County, Arcata, I mean, things have definitely, being more aware and being more conscious of myself and how things are set up around me as far as social interactions dealing with race and class and sexual orientation and all that. I actually go through life as well. I mean, going to school, my main mission up here in Arcata was to go to school, and that's it. Or, you know, throughout the next move in my life, that's it. Just me being Michael, Mikey, you know, what's next for me, and so on and so forth. But I have my moments where I do see and recognize little, like I said earlier, Michael aggressions. And it's happened many times. And I started noticing it when I was, you know, in my teen years, 13, 14, you know, especially with the way I talk. Beginning with that, it was always, it's just like, after people hear me talk, they always ask me, so, are you, what are you? As in, like, are you black, are you white, are you mixed? And is your mom white? And stuff like that. And it's just, no. That's
it's not called tuition.
Exactly. It's just, I mean, I was...
It's education.
My mother...
I'm an articulate man.
Exactly. I mean, it's really weird, I mean, for people to approach me about, you know, my articulation and just the way I talk.
You speak well for a black guy.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just like, no, my mom, my dad kind of taught me how to talk. and of course, just, you know, the you know, walking down the street. I mean, I noticed some things, noticed these same things up here as well as in L.A., but up here for sure, being, a you know, a black male in a mostly white space. Walking down the street, it's, I see people kind of like fidgeting a little bit, kind of like, you know, changing up their whole, their stature and in the way they walk. And it's just like, all right, well, I know what this is, so let me throw on a smile, say hello, or, you know, change up myself a little bit to make myself a little bit more friendlier, because I don't want to come off as, you know, the angry black guy. And there's also those times when, you know, even I talk about music, you know, music will come up, and people know I love music. And there are some times where it's just like, oh, you know, so Mikey, have you heard this new rapper's album, or have you heard this new hip hop track? And it's just like, and you know, if I say no, then they'll be a little taken back by it. Like, wait, really? But
you're a black guy.
You're black. Or, you know, don't you listen to hip hop? And it's just like, come on, like, are you serious?
Yes, you know, they are.
I can go on with that for days upon days, but I definitely have my moments, you know, when it's just like, all right, well, I gotta, you know, be black today, I guess, be the token black today, or, you know, it's just really awkward a little bit, because I know I'm black, but these people just really, I don't know, it's, yeah.
And John,
see, my experience was very different from that. I moved here in 1980, mm-hmm. and I was the kid from Oakland who spent most of his time backpacking in Yosemite, pounding fence poles in Yuba City as a wrangler, yeah. Riding horses. So when I came up here, the assimilation process was fairly easy. I remember being taken in by a Portuguese family in the Janeiros and teaching me how to play soccer and how to just become a part of the community here. And they loved on me. And I think part of that, my experience, just because it's been over a 37-year period, when I'm walking down the street, because of that history, because I've been with, for the most part, your Boy Scout Scoutmaster, your Sunday school teacher, your DARE officer, your soccer coach, that interaction with me from the community at large has always been, hey, it's Packer. Matter of fact, I can't go anywhere without being Officer Packer, in uniform or out of uniform. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But I can be standing in the Safeway in McKinleyville, and the checker will greet me and say, hey, Officer Packer, how's it going today? You know, my son was your dear kid, nice. You know, 13 years ago, 15 years ago, and this is what he or she is doing. But I think a lot of that has to do with just the time that I've been in the community and the familiarity that we have with each other here, which definitely plays a role in how effective I can be as an officer when I am out on the street, and how I can open up a conversation with different groups in our community.
Right. If you would like to join in the conversation, call 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. We have a caller from Eureka. Sandra, what is your question or comment?
I was just a little, maybe almost disturbed to hear all of the positive talk about Louis Farrakhan, because I'm old enough to remember that he was implicated in the assassination of Malcolm X.
Okay. I'm 47 years old. I was born after the death of Malcolm X, but I do remember Elijah Muhammad and Minister Louis Farrakhan were implicated in that. So I do understand your comment, but there have been positive things that he has said and done within the black community.
Yeah.
Like I said, I have seen brothers in L.A. who used to don gang attire, and then all of a sudden there was a switch and they were donning suits and bow ties.
Yeah.
Speaking in a different tone with a different message.
Yeah.
So there are some negatives, but...
That's a pretty big negative to be implicated in the assassination of Malcolm X.
Absolutely, absolutely, but people change.
I would just like to hear what the panel there knows about it, thinks about it. That's it. I'm going to get off now and listen online.
Okay, thank you for your comment.
Thank you, Sandra. And, but as I said earlier, I'm not that well-versed with Louis Farrakhan. It's just really interesting because even though I went to school for a little bit of my primary years at Marcus Garvey Middle School, he never really came up in history. Or even when I came to school up here, never really came up in history. So I'm not that versed in him. But as I said before, what I've heard and... what I've seen a little bit here and there on TV or over the radio or in conversations, there was some good that was spoken of him, but there was also some bad, one being the implications, with him dealing with him being a part of Malcolm X assassination. And I honestly can't speak any more on it,
Right. So
I can speak to it now. So I'm 50. Born, grew up in the Bay Area, so during that time period, in the 70s of being a young kid, graduated from high school in 80, so let's say 75 to 80 in that time period from being 13 to 18, we were involved with, we saw the dynamics of the Brotherhood, of the Black Panthers, of the Symbionese Liberation Army, People's Park, when it was actually a park. I mean, it had vegetables in it and the protests that were going on outside of Berkeley. And I think from just looking in retrospect from the young lady's comment on the air is that as individuals, we have to set aside the rhetoric. I personally do. And I look to what's the character of the person and what are the actual goals that person has. And so for some people, they grabbed a hold of what Louis Farrakhan was saying, others, Malcolm X, others, Martin Luther King, and so on. And I think that, for me, is probably more important that if you're going to take a position on one of the keynotes of that era, whether it be black or white or any other color, that it be based on where do you stand the direction they're going and the character that they bring to the table. And for some people, Louis Farrakhan did not have a bar that they were willing to agree with. For others, they did. But each of those men and those groups in that time period, what I would say, had a basis for their stance that was both passionate and that they were willing to articulate and step out and speak upon.
Absolutely. So I am the mother of a 26-year-old son, and I remember having the talk with him And it wasn't about sex ed. It was about navigating through this world as a black man. Do you gentlemen remember having that talk about, you know, don't look menacing, put a smile on your face if you have to code switch and not have too much bass in your voice? Do you remember having that talk?
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think contemporarily, right now, we were conditioned to think that way and to behave that way. But I think when we see a lot of these incidents unfold with the police and young black men and some of the other things we see in the media when it comes to black men here in America, I think these young brothers are saying, like, I don't have to perform that way anymore. And they're just going to be who they are, where they are, when they are. And I think that's the contemporary space. So, and that causes conflict, that causes fear, that causes people feel threatened by that. But these brothers have a right to be that way, because, like I say, you know, a generation ago or two generations ago, a lot of black men could not do that. They couldn't be themselves. Right. And I think this whole idea of black identity now has become so mainstream and so pervasive that, you know, I'm reading articles about this, another story in Kansas City, the plaza in Kansas City, and how they're trying to deal with black youths in this really prominent area in Kansas City. And there was a time when they could say, you just can't come down here, just, you know, stay away. And the kids would have to. But now they're saying, well, I don't have to stay away, and I can come down there, and whether it's right or wrong, and I can cause havoc. And because, you know, white kids have caused havoc in certain spaces for all these years too. So it's just, it's interesting that you mentioned that about how we've been conditioned. And I think the conditioning now with the millennials, as we call them, they're saying, hey, I am who I am.
Yeah. I mean, to really bounce off of that a little bit, it's gotten to a point where it's just like, all right, well, I'm kind of tired.
Yeah.
You know, putting on this facade. I'm tired of putting on this mask. Like, I want to feel like how I feel. If I feel like being angry, I feel like being angry. If I'm tired, I want to feel like I'm tired. If I want to dress this way, I should be able to dress this way, because everybody else can. How come, you know, I can't do that? And of course, I had to, my mom had those talks with me, you know, once in a while. I mean, being from South Central LA, kind of have to hold yourself in a certain manner, and dressing a certain way was part of it, and talking again was another thing. And I was also told at one point, well, at that point, the police officers were there, you know, to do us a service, to be there for us. However, saw that wasn't the case, and it's becoming more prevalent in the media. In the now, yeah, I've definitely had that talk with my mother, and every morning before my brother and my sister, before we went out to go to school, we actually had prayer, you know, and that was pretty much, it was a day-to-day thing, you know. Before we left the house, we had to pray.
I've always said there's nothing more powerful than a black mama's prayer over her children. And that's the truth.
Yeah.
What about you?
I don't know. I you know, my conversations are twofold. One, my mother, when we left the house, when I left the house, her encouragement wasn't necessarily based on how law enforcement would perceive me in our community, but rather how other people, everyone would perceive me. And we were asked to behave as God would have us behave. And that was paramount in our family. My father, on the other hand, and I had several discussions, but they revolved around why a black man would want to be a police officer. And that was because my parents were born in 1927 in New Mississippi in Birmingham, Alabama. So our conversations, as I got older, revolved more around trying to understand why I would become part of what he saw as a white establishment, and how I would come to grips.
Okay. You are breaking up a little bit, so you might want to move to another part of the house, John. So I think we do have another caller, Habib, perhaps calling back from Arcata is on the line. Habib?
Yes, hello. Thanks for receiving me once more. I'll be real quick.
Okay.
But one caller called in trying to say that Louis Farrakhan was somehow implicated in Malcolm X's assassination.
Right.
And actually, there were three men who were convicted of that crime, and that the FBI thoroughly investigated Minister Farrakhan, and he was never charged with that crime. He broke with him because Malcolm X wanted to break away from Elijah Muhammad, and he exposed the fact that Elijah Muhammad had extramarital affairs. This is all in the autobiography of Malcolm X. I'm not making any of this up.
Right.
And so I just wanted to say that that's not fair, because that is another thing that the media always repeats is, oh, he killed. But you know what? One thing I wanted to say that's never been touched upon is the greatest black leader America had, Martin Luther King, shot down in 1968. And I have, you know, his family don't believe it was that one man that did it. In fact, they exonerated him. And there's a video on YouTube called History of Revision where you can watch the whole explanation of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and the FBI is involved according to this documentary. So that's something I think we really need to address too, is how strong black men threaten people not only on the street level but at a higher power level. Thank you for allowing me to share my comment.
Thank you. You know, there is another HNIC, that's a head Negro in charge, President Barack Obama, and he's questioned frequently as a black man, and in my opinion, many times not respected for his position solely because of his race and the color of his skin. So, an amazing thing. You going to say something, Kurt? Okay. Do we have another caller on the line? I am getting the name of that caller. If you have a question or call, 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. From Hyattsville, we have Therese on the line. Therese?
Yes.
Yeah, your question or comment?
Oh, I'm just really, really thrilled. I was driving in my car and I heard this conversation is taking place. It's really needed in our community and globally that people talk like this. And I'm a white woman. I've been married for 44 years to a beautiful black man, and I've raised three of the most beautiful black children in the world. And you know, and I think that we should have this conversation more, that we maybe should do this on like a weekly or a monthly, you know, time schedule, and that it would be just so wonderful for black and white teenagers, you know, because we've got to break the cycle somehow, you know. I mean, we have lingerings of the Civil War still. Come on.
Yes.
You know, we need to get out of this, and we need to change.
Yes. Well,
and
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I do thank you for your comment.
Thank you, Therese.
Actually, it seems as though this is becoming my theme when I host the show. So you can look forward to conversations on race on a regular basis, on a monthly basis, when I host the show here on Thursday.
Wonderful. Because I have, like, my boys, they've gone through a lot, and my oldest teenager. Well, actually, he's not a teenager anymore. He's officially not a teenager anymore, but he just went through so much, and it's really hard. It was really hard for him to awaken when he awakened to, you know, that the color of his skin mattered. Mm-hmm. And it's taken him through a lot of changes, and he really needs to have talks like these, you know, and talk with other people and know that other people go through the same kind of things that he goes through, you know?
Absolutely. It is a village that helps in the rearing. of our children. So we are here.
Well, that's really good to know.
Yes.
And I will be listening. Is it usually at the 7 o'clock hour on Thursdays?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for your comment.
Thank you.
You are so welcome, and thank you.
Yes. We only have about 5 more minutes. I think there is one more caller, and we will wrap up the show with final comments from these 3 strong black men here.
Thank you.
And I will end with a special song dedicated to you brothers at the end of the show as well.
Thank you.
Okay, so final comments from you each. Let's start with John Packer.
Thank you for having me on the show, first of all. It's been interesting to hear the callers, a few of them that came in, but it's probably more important to have the dialogue. I'd love to continue in this, and I'd like to pose a question, and it's kind of rhetorical, but to get to the point where we take race out of the racial issue, a conversation that gets to the point where if you took a group of individuals and if you look at the black experience and you subjected anyone to that type of experience over time, that what really would you expect the outcome to be? And I think that's something that we need to really talk about. Anyway, if we talk about being angry at society and being angry at the position that a young man feels, since we're talking about black young men, if anyone was placed in a situation over time repetitively with that experience, why is it we are surprised or shocked by that response?
Absolutely. Mikey?
Thank you for having me. Definitely appreciate the invitation and actually being here and listening to the multiple perspectives and the questions and comments that were brought in, and actually having this conversation, because it doesn't happen often. But when it does, it's always refreshing, it's always revitalizing, and it definitely keeps me on my toes and more aware and comfortable, because I'm not the only one feeling these feelings and thinking these thoughts. That's pretty much. Thank you.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, I enjoyed the conversation tonight too. And I just wanted to we talk about media, and we have a lot of conversations about mainstream media, but I just encourage people in general to, if you want to get a more broader perspective on culture, people, blackness, I mean, you got to go beyond mainstream media. You got to check out the alternative spaces. You got to, you know, because it's a vast, really vast, you know, identity, and the mainstream media just doesn't get it.
Absolutely. I want to cue the music, and we'll start the music and have it playing in the background. Angie Stone sang a song in 2002 honoring her black men. It's called Brother. And I dedicate this not only to the brothers who are part of this conversation, but also to those all around.
Yes, he's my son, so I can talk to him, 'cause he understands everything I go through and everything I am. He's my support system, I can't live without him. The best thing since sliced bread is his kiss, his hugs, his lips, his touch. And I just want the whole world to know about my black brother. I love you, and I'll never try to hurt you. I want you to know that I'm here for you forever.
You have been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Lorna Bryant, and our guests, Kirby Moss, Mikey Matthews, and Sergeant John Packer. Please email. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email Thursday Night Talk at KHSU and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming next week to Thursday Night Talk, who says sports, race, and politics don't mix well? On the next Thursday Night Talk, Doc Stoll and Brenda Starr examine sports as seen through the lens of race, politics, and protests throughout our history. Tune in and join the conversation August 18th, beginning at 7. Thanks to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. No Room for Squares is coming up next.